Our first guest on Guhuna Achtuahin, Voices of 81, is Bec McFarlane. When Bobby Sands went on hunger strike on the 1st of March 1981, Bec took on the role of Officer Commanding, or OC, of the H Block prisoners in Long Cash. He reflects here on that hugely difficult time, the challenges faced by all involved, and the comradeship within the jail that boosted their morale, even on the darkest of days.
Well, at the beginning of 1981, into January, we became acutely aware that the Brits weren't going to move on any promises of introducing any measures whatsoever. And we had tried a variety of moves to try and get us out of the situation, off the blanket protest, and into some sort of working environment, or some sort of environment where you could, you could get your clothes or get something sorted out to get out of protest mode. What happened was Bobby Sands was the OC at the time, and I distinctly remember a meeting that he had with Hilditch, who was the number one governor, at the end of January, when Hilditch said to Bobby that unless Republican prisoners came off this protest, put on this criminal uniform, and abided by the rules and regulations of his staff, and not any IRA staff, until they did that, nobody would be going anywhere. In this, in a sense, that was the breaker of us moving into a second hunger strike. Now, we had been arguing with our leadership outside about hunger strike, as we did for the first hunger strike, and they had been pretty vehemently opposed to hunger strike action for a variety of factors, and we were arguing with them consistently that we were at last course of action here. We had nowhere else to go. And unless they could provide us with a feasible or a viable alternative to hunger strike action that did not involve total and utter surrender of our politics or our political status, then certainly if they could provide us with a viable alternative, we would certainly listen to that. But it ended up they came back and they said that they couldn't. And that propelled us into the second hunger strike. Bobby Sands, as OC of the Republican prisoners, was to lead that hunger strike, and we developed a strategy that one man would go first, followed 2 weeks later by a second, followed a week or so later by two more. So Bobby was to be followed by Francis Hughes, to be followed a week later by Patsy O'Hara and Raymond McCreesh, and it was staggered. A lot of people thought, you know, looking back on this here, people have asked us, or have asked me, and different people that have come up with a comment that, you know, were very sort of clinical, hard-nosed in terms of your attitude to this. And I would say yes, but we also developed a replacement strategy in order to send a very, very clear signal to the Brits that if anybody died in hunger strike, they would be replaced with another hunger striker, letting everybody know that we weren't for lying down here. Also, that the individual had the responsibility to terminate or not his hunger strike. So the total responsibility fell on the shoulders of the individual who was in hunger strike, which is harsh, which is hard, but unfortunately, the nature of the circumstances, that's where we found ourselves. Bobby had come back from a visit, and at the time, if I'm not mistaken, I think Donny Morrison had been on the visit, if it wasn't prior to him being excluded from the prison. He'd come back from the visit and just given a bit of news and how things were going. And in the midst of it, you know, he was talking and he says, oh yeah, and I told him that you'd be taken over. And I said, taken over what? He says, I told him to tell the lads outside that you'd be taken over as OC. I says, I'm not taking over OC, I'm the PRO. I'm the guy that organises the letter writing campaign. I'm the guy that writes the letters or gets guys to contact people. And he says, no. I'm not having it any other way. I've just told him that that's the way it's going to be. And I says, well, I'm not doing that. He says, well, you have to do it. I says, I am not even up there on the list of the packing order in terms of, you know, the pay scale, because there's an OC, there's a vice OC, there's an adjutant, there's an education officer. I says, you've everything. I says, I'm stuck down at the bottom of that list. I says, there are other people more senior than me. I says, for example, I says, Shana Walsh is the vice OC. I says, he's been in the cages with you, he's been out, he's back in, and he knows the politics of this protest upside down, inside out, possibly better than anybody else. I says, and he's next in line. And then Bobby said to me, yeah, there's only one thing you're missing there. And I says, I'm not missing anything. Oh, you are? He says, he's my best mate. And I says, and what has that got to do with anything? He says, well, quite frankly, he says, see if this hunger strike goes the distance and we reach a crisis period and the Brits just decide, they may decide at some stage to introduce negotiations. He says, if I end up in a crisis period and this come to negotiations and the package that they put on the table is not acceptable. He says, he'll not let me die. And I says, so what you're saying is that I would let you die? Yeah, that's right. I says, well, thanks very much for that vote of confidence in my capabilities and my sensitivities. I says, he says, no. I know the crack with you, and that's the way it has to be. So you need to do it. And there was no answer after that because, I mean, I just felt that the vote of confidence that he had in me and his faith in what I'd be able to do was far more than what I felt that I was able to do. So very, very reluctantly then at the end of that, I'm saying to myself, here's a man here putting himself on the line, putting his life on the line to all intents and purposes. He knows the minute that he steps onto this that he's not coming out the other end of it. And he has the confidence in me to help him along that road. And if push comes to shove, that I need to be able to say to the Brits, that's not what he asked for. That's not what the hunger strikers want. So there's no deal. Up until the start of the second hunger strike, we still had continued the No Wash protest, which was the blanket protest. We decided that it was a distraction. And at the end of a second hunger strike, we were not going to be having a No Wash protest or any other type of protest like that, because nothing else would be of the same magnitude as a hunger strike. You know, if you have a hunger strike and a No Wash protest, you know, it's a bit confusing. So the decision was taken to end the No Wash, which meant that as in from the 1st of March, all prisoners should be able to get out to the showers, use the toilets, use the showers, the washrooms, etc. Which ended up extremely problematical, because once we ended that, the screws in the jail started only letting out two people at a time, and you might have had 38, 40, 40 odd people on a wing. And there was conflict with that, and there was arguments over around that, and they were messing. I mean, they messed Bobby Sands a bit, and the difficulty for people like me in a position of responsibility is you wanted that when your door opened that you just smash somebody's face in, but you could not afford to do that because that distracts from what's in train, that the focus needed to be on Bobby Sands. And I know that other prisoners, some very, very tough guys around that jail, just had said to me, screw messing him about and teasing about his food. When my door opens, he says, I'll just shove my dinner in his face. I mean, no, you won't. Leave it the way it is. The lads were incensed. Morale was very high once the hunger strike started, because they knew and they felt that this is the train, this is the lane, this is the road to travel that's going to end this nightmare of 5 years. It's 5 years. This went on from September 76 to October 1981 of a continuous, brutal protest. Now it was going to culminate with a hunger strike. Morale was very high. People were very supportive. The news coming from outside, through the first hunger strike as well, and into the second hunger strike, of the support on the streets, we were getting regular reports. And then when you went into the second hunger strike, there was no fouling of the cells. Everything was clean. You then began to get access to a newspaper every so often, and you were able to read stuff. Not that you're going to take what the Irish Times would say or the British media, but it was a bit of an outlet. And you're able to get a book in, you know, people were able to read. So there was that extra aspect of it that, you know, you weren't sitting in a very, very dirty cell and you were able to give your support. Now, hunger strikers generally would have been kept in the wing up to 3 weeks before transfer to the prison hospital. And Bobby was in our wing. Everybody was doing their utmost to try and help out in whatever way they could, you know, did he need anything. We got Philip Rooney into the cell next door to him because he was in the cell on his own. Got Philip Rooney next door, who was able to go in and out of his cell every day just to clean his brush his cell out and tidy things up for him. And obviously, whatever notes needed to be smuggled, Philip was in a position to do that. Just when we're talking about that there, Bobby started on the first day of his hunger strike to compile a diary. And the diary went for 17 days. It actually concluded on St. Patrick's Day. We had a bit of a concert on that day. You know, it's a tremendous piece of writing. And it's actually just about to be re-released on Monday the 1st. And he just kept this diary every day. Philip Rooney was able to collect that and keep it safe until it was smuggled out and released. It was actually released in June that year of 1981. But we tried to keep contact with him, do the normal things of, you know, continuing to do your Irish classes, continuing to have a quiz, you know, have a sing-song, or people telling stories, etc., etc. And we would ask Bobby, you know, if there was anything he wanted done or any requests he had. So morale was good. A lot of angry people about, but morale was good. On the Sunday morning, when Bobby Sands started hunger strike, we had already discussed a replacement strategy, and we had asked prisoners around, Republican prisoners around the camp, if anybody wanted to volunteer for hunger strike. Now, I ended up somewhere in the region of about 70, 80 names of people who were prepared for hunger strike. So out of that, we developed a number of automatic replacements. Tried to do it on a geographical basis as well, so that it would be around the six counties that you'd have representation. But on that Sunday morning at Mass, we got out, put the prison trousers on, and went out to Mass in the canteen. And in a conversation that Bobby had with me, and if my mind serves me correctly, I think Jake Jackson might have been with me at the time. And Bobby was talking about a variety of things and everything in place and what way he felt after coming back from the doctor and getting his measurements and his weight and all the rest of it. And then he said about, okay, that replacement strategy, is everything sorted? And I said, yeah, everything's all right. He says, well, who have you got to replace me? And I was sort of taken aback a wee bit, because this was a sort of very finite type of question. And I says, what do you mean? He says, well, who did you pick to replace me? Who is it? And I says, well, I mean, you're starting your hunger strike today. You have a family visit tomorrow. I think you should be concerning yourself more about focusing on that and you know, getting yourself prepared for your family and all, and we'll sort that out. And then he looked at me dead straight, very serious, and he says to me, you need to have your head around this and this replacement strategy, because I'm telling you straight, see, in 2 months' time, I'm not going to be here. And you're going to have to know precisely where you're going and where this protest is going. You're going to need to know. So who did you pick to replace me? And I was just sort of dumbfounded. And it was a wee bit emotionally tight, you know, harsh. And I says, well, you know, if you must know, I says, it's Joe McDonald. And he stopped for a second and he looked at me and he says, that's a good choice. Joe McDonald will never let you down. And then in the next breath, he says, who did you say had the tobacco for me? And I says, Philip or somebody down in the corner. Right, see you later. And I think I just looked at Jake. I don't even know if we said anything like, can you believe that? Or we just looked at each other, mesmerized. But here was the measure of the individual facing into the first day of his hunger strike and not looking beyond the last day, because there was no beyond the last day. So totally and absolutely focused. And that, in a sense, allowed us to look down the road that this is gonna cost us big time. And that's the way he developed throughout the entire hunger strike. Now, there were a variety of situations when we had the likes of Francis Hughes coming on and Patsy and Raymond coming on as well the following week after Francis. You're left with a situation of trying to get communications with them. Bobby was kept in my wing until day 23. Then they transferred him to prison hospital. Then obviously the communication relied on smuggled notes and etc. But obviously his communication with outside people like Jim Gibney, Joe Austin, people like that were able to get up on visits with us. Jim Gibney particularly would have been able to visit the hunger strikers. The lawyer, Pat Finucane, was able to get in regular because he was their representative, which was important, as well as just having somebody for a visit. But for the families, and enough cannot be said about the families, because the biggest impact outside of the impact on the individual on hunger strike was the emotional trauma and the stresses and the pain and the heartache visited upon families. And when you consider that, you know, people like Joe McDonald's kid, Bobby Sands' kid, you know, people like that were, you know, 6, 7, 8 years of age or something at the time, and their parents, their partners, kids, their family circle. And in one sense, you see, that was a measure of the strength that we drew on, because people would say to me, look, that must have been an awful period. And I would say, yeah, worst year of my life. The pressure was unbelievable and didn't know how I was going to work my way through it. And then when you see the likes of Bobby Sands' mother outside the prison, you know, photographing the Irish Times or on the news, we didn't see the news, but, you know, the smuggled radio, you know, you were able to hear that, you know, my son is dying. Then you see the photograph of Jared Sands or Joe McDonald's, we let, hanging over the coffin. You realise that you're not, in terms of pressure, in terms of stress and emotional pain, you're not in the same league. You cannot, doesn't matter what you do or what position you hold or how close you are to the individual, you are not anywhere in that league. That is in a different league altogether. And in one sense, you know, where I would say to myself, you know, how am I going to hack this? How am I? Then you just stop and you think, how am I going to? How are they going to do that? Don't even, and I'm saying to myself, don't even begin to put yourself on the same level or in the same bracket as family members of hunger strikers, because you're not in their league. So get off your arse and do better tomorrow than you did today, and make a focus and do as much as you can. And then we would spread that out to everybody. We'll tell everybody, look lads, we're the people in the good situation. We may be on a blanket protest, maybe brutal, maybe hard. These are the people in the prison hospital. They're leading the charge in the struggle. So focus on that. Now there's a question that a lot of people ask me, you know, how long did you know Bobby Sands, you know, Patsy O'Hara, whoever, Thomas McElwee? I was doubled up in a cell with Thomas McElwee for a couple of weeks at one stage. But my situation was actually different, and there were a number of us who were in a different situation than everybody who came through the remand period from 1976 onwards, because they all came through a remand period where political status had been withdrawn. I had political status. I was in the cages. So I didn't come through jail with all these guys until the first day that I landed on the blanket protest. And it was only then I began to meet people. Of all the hunger strikers, I ended up visiting the prison hospital on numerous occasions. I've lost count of many occasions. But there were only two hunger strikers that I never physically met, but I wrote to them. One was Francis Hughes and one was Patsy O'Hara. I mean, it was a difficult situation, and you know, these are people that you become friendly with, they're comrades, and it's hard hitting all the way down the lane, and especially going to visit them in the prison hospital. And I remember the European Commission for Human Rights sent a delegation over with two commissioners and two assistants. The screws just came to my cell one Sunday morning, opened the door and said, prison hospital, you're required at the prison hospital, put your gear on. No information, nothing at all. And I thought, what, something's happening here? What's going on? This was about 10 days or so before Bobby Sands died. And when I got to prison hospital, I mean, there were a variety of, interventions as such. Prior to that there, you know, the Pope sent an envoy. There were British politicians, Irish politicians, people like that had come in during the course of it. So I had gone up to prison hospital, met the commissioners. But the proviso that the hunger strikers had laid down on ourselves was that if there were to be any negotiations or any interventions, were some sort of back and forward with the British established, with the British NIO, British ministers, had to be taken into consideration, that if we were going to be negotiating an end to the hunger strike, we required two advisors from outside, which we nominated Gerry Adams and Danny Morrison. So when the commissioners told me that the British had told them that they weren't allowed in, I says, well, it just takes a phone call. And I says, they can be in, which will then prove that if Bobby Sands has these two people in the prison hospital, there's absolutely no problem whatsoever in getting into a sit-down session with yourselves. And then they told me that they had been pre-told before they came in that Gerry Adams and Donnie Morrison were persona non grata and would not be gaining access to the prison. So I knew before I went into his cell that was the situation, and I knew that there's no way was he going to meet those commissioners in the absence of what we put down. And the other aspect of it, that he recognised it immediately. So I asked him, can I go to the prison cell or up to his hospital cell to see him? And they said, yeah. So I went up, I went in, and you know, he was lying propped up on the bed in pillows, and the medic who was with me in the white coat was speaking very, very quietly, as if like noise would disturb the environment. The medic, I remember, was a decent sort of character. Right? So as I walked in, Bobby looked up, and it was only when I got to the edge of the bed that he recognised who it was, because his vision was impaired, his breathing was laboured, his cheeks were sunken, his eyes had dark rims around them, and his voice was very, very weak. And so I went over and sat by the bedside and told him, crack, it was me. And he says to me right away, what is it? I says, these commissioners were up. He says, yeah, they've been trying to get to see me. Why are you up? I says, well, they've brought me up as well. I says, I'm only after speaking to them and told them what the proviso was. And then he says, where's the big lad? I says, they're not letting him in. And it was at that minute, I says, they told me that him and Donny are not permitted. The Brits have told them that they're not allowing them into the prison. And that was the minute that he says, that's it then. They're not serious about the negotiations. This is just to tide things over. And I says, yeah, it looks like that. So we spoke for about 10 minutes. And at the end of it, he was asking me about the women comrades in Armagh, because he always was paying particular attention to contact with him. And I says, you know, they're in in regular touch with me. Like, so Sheila Darren there would be regularly contacting me, and he was at pains to point that he wanted regards sent on to him. I says, I'll do that. And then he was asking about all the lads in the wing and around the block, and we just had, like, it was general chit chat, you know, about everybody else. And then he said to me that that's it, isn't it? I says, well, I can't see them moving here. He says, I'm dying, Cara, I'm dying. And that's the last that he spoke to me, and I just left. I went back and told the commissioners that unless Gerry Adams and Donnie Morrison were afforded access as advisors, then Bobby Sands, they would not be able to meet with Bobby Sands. And that was it. That's the last time that I saw him.